You'll find that on pages 553 and 554 of your pew Bible. Ecclesiastes 2, 1 to 11. I said in my heart, come now, I will test you with pleasure. Enjoy yourself. But behold, this also was vanity. I said of laughter, it is mad, and of pleasure, what use is it? I searched with my heart how to cheer my body with wine, my heart still guiding me with wisdom, and how to lay hold on folly that I might see what was good for the children of man to do under heaven during the few days of their life. I made great works. I built houses and planted vineyards for myself. I made myself gardens and parks and planted in them all kinds of fruit trees. I made myself pools from which to water the forest of growing trees. I bought male and female slaves and had slaves who were born in my house. I had also great possessions of herds and flocks, more than any who had been before me in Jerusalem. I also gathered for myself silver and gold and the treasure of kings and provinces. I got singers, both men and women, and many concubines, the delight of the children of man. So I became great and surpassed all who were before me in Jerusalem. Also my wisdom remained with me. And whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. I kept my heart from no pleasure, for my heart found pleasure in all my toil, and this was my reward for all my toil. Then I considered all that my hands had done, and the toil I had expended in doing it. And behold, all was vanity and a striving after wind, and there was nothing to be gained under the sun. According to Dr. Paul McGee of helpguide.org, laughter is truly the best medicine. Consider these benefits demonstrated in the laboratory of laughter and humor in your life. Laughter relaxes the whole body. A good, healthy, hearty laugh relieves physical tension and stress, leaving your muscles relaxed for up to 45 minutes after a good laugh. Laughter also boosts the immune system. Laughter decreases stress hormones, increases immune cells and infection-fighting antibodies, improving your resistance to disease. Laughter triggers the release of endorphins, the body's natural feel-good chemicals. Any of you that work out know this, don't you? Endorphins promote an overall sense of well-being, can even temporarily relieve pain. Laughter also protects the heart, Laughter improves the function of blood vessels and increases blood flow, which can help protect you against a heart attack and other cardiovascular problems. Well, medicine has always observed the mental health benefits of laughter as well. Laughter dissolves distressing emotions. You can't feel anxious, angry, or sad when you're laughing, can you? Unless you're a sarcastic SOB, then that's a different story, though, and we need to work on some other things. Laughter also helps you relax and recharge. It reduces stress, increases energy, enabling you to stay focused and accomplish more as well. Humor also shifts perspective, doesn't it? Allowing you to see situations in a more realistic, less threatening light. A humorous perspective creates psychological distance, helps objectify things, can help you avoid feeling overwhelmed. In other words, it just feels good, doesn't it? It feels good to laugh. So, go out and find laughter in life. Watch your government at work, for example. I didn't think it would get that big of a laugh. But enjoy. Go tickle a grizzly bear. Man, you better not do that. Don't take that literally. But tie a pork chop to your dog's tail and watch what happens. Ask the Friedels how to clean a toilet with a cat. Go ask a Buddhist if he could have a burger, would it be one with everything? Go watch an evening of Robin. I didn't think that would make you laugh. Yeah, okay. Well, Just go watch Robin Williams on The Tonight Show. But when you think of professional comedians, too, it's instructive to note that the best of us among us who can make us laugh, the ones that get paid for it, there is a tragic irony, too, of just how psychologically unbalanced comedians are in their own personal lives. That's the dark side, isn't it, of comedy. Jamie Masada, who is owner of the famous Laugh Factory, he's seen them all on his stage in the course of his 20-odd years. Robin Williams, Sam Kinison, Rodney Dangerfield, Richard Pryor, John Belushi, to name just but a few, ones we know. But they all had issues. And Masada, he never intended to do this, but he became a kind of counselor to the comedy world, listening to life stories, dispensing his own brand of homespun wisdom. And Masada contends that the best comedians are all compensating for serious mental and emotional traumas in their past. Some were sexually or emotionally abused as children. Others were mercilessly teased, made to feel inadequate. Others lost a parent to divorce or death, some such trauma in their lives. But in each and every case, they found ways to cope with serious distress and trauma. The way to do this was to laugh or to make others laugh. Well, what's the result then, dear brother and sister? What is the result of all of this? Salvation? Redemption? Does it work? Does humor and laughter and good times bring lasting comfort and relief? Of course, we know the answer to that, don't we? No, of course it does not. At the end of every round of laughter, there's a serious silence, as Masada says. While indeed there was temporary respite from the pain of life and laughter, there was no lasting comfort in it. Its effects and its power seemed to evaporate, to dissipate, to disappear as if it were just vapor after all. As we saw in Proverbs today, even in laughter the heart may ache, and the end of joy may be grief. Therefore, you see the emotional, psychological, physical, and spiritual wreckage of the comedy world, don't you? Robin Williams, a willing participant in drug addiction. Sam Kinison, drug overdose and death. John Belushi, drug overdose and death. Richard Pryor, drug addiction. And on the list goes, doesn't it? Well, long before the days of comedy clubs and stand-up routines, another great man plumbed the depths of mirth, laughter, and good times. King Solomon. King Solomon. He could afford to set up the perfect comedy club, if you will. He was richer and more famous than them all. In fact, this is precisely along the lines of what he did. In our text today is a brief summary of the record of what he discovered about the enduring nature of jollity, luxury, and work, too. Work as well. What are his conclusions? Let's turn to our text here today. 3 points I want to make with you this day concerning our text. First of all, in verses 1 and 3, this point encompasses verses 1 and 3, pleasure. This is his basic. Sawat is the Hebrew word there for pleasure. And that is his pursuit this day through several venues. Pleasure. What would a wise man with unparalleled opportunity, what would he conclude about the enduring quality of pleasure in jollity? Laughter, humor, jollity. Well, Solomon launches out upon this great sea of everything that is done under the sun. Remember from chapter 1? This is his mission. His euphemism, if you will, for all of human activity pursued with an end to lasting effect. And he opens with this bill of particulars. This is his beginning. Now, after the introduction we've seen in the last couple of weeks, this is his beginning, his bill of particulars. Pleasure. Pleasure. Lots seek pleasure under the sun, don't they, in this life? pleasure as it is relished in jollity, luxury, and work. And this he does with a Shakespearean soliloquy to his own heart. I said in my heart, come now. Come now, I will test you with pleasure. Enjoy yourself. I like the King James. Go to now, I will prove thee with mirth. That sounds much more Shakespearean, doesn't it? But it does sound like an excellent way to begin a comedy routine, doesn't it? And as Solomon so often does, he gives us his conclusion in advance. Have you noticed that here? It's not a mystery. It's not a whodunit. He gives us his conclusions in the beginning. He says, pleasure is but a vapor. Here and gone so quickly, isn't it? We know that from experience, don't we? As fun, fulfilling, and frivolous as it may be for the moment, one is still the same person he was before the clever line, before facing those demons when he came into the joke. He still faces those same demons he did before that glass of wine, weighted with the same depressing memories before buying and driving that sports car, fitted with the same furniture of the soul before he built and moved into that great McMansion that he built for himself. Pleasure indeed is vaporous, fleeting, ephemeral, isn't it? As good as it is to laugh, and Solomon is not saying that it is not good to laugh or that we should not laugh. As good as it is to laugh, one must know when and where to draw the line. Once again, he expects to have at your elbow a copy of the Proverbs, 1 Kings 1 through 11, not to mention the whole weight of the Decalogue with you as well. One must know where to draw the line. As he says in Proverbs chapter 10, doing wrong is like a joke to a fool, but wisdom is pleasure to a man of understanding. He expects you to have that under your belt as too. Wisdom, having understanding, not seeing doing wrong as a joke. He says in Proverbs 14, even in laughter the heart may ache, the end of joy may be grief. Proverbs 26, like a madman who throws firebrands, arrows, and death is the man who deceives his neighbor and says, I was only joking. You ever know people like that, that are just cruel and say, oh, I was only playing a prank on you, I was only joking? Huh. From Proverbs 29, if a wise man has an argument with a fool, the fool only rages and laughs, and there is no quiet. Reminds me of Bill Maher. Bill Maher has one button on his control board, and that's withering sarcasm, laughing at others. So in keeping with the wisdom literature, Koheleth ponders, laughter is madness. Laughter is madness. Pleasure begs the rhetorical question, what does it accomplish? I like that translation better. Better than the ESV's, what use is it? Or the KJV's, what doeth it? What does pleasure accomplish? That is, what endures afterwards? What is there after the mirth and the happiness dissipate? We must be very careful, too, not to answer these just yet or jump to the conclusion that Koheleth is the despairing existentialist a la Kafka that we saw last week. Solomon then turns to laughter's sister image, that is wine. Wine, yes. Surely, pleasure that endures must be found here, right? You make wine to gladden the heart of man, the psalmist says, oil to make his face shine, bread to strengthen the man's heart. Wine has a distinguished place in the Bible. It is a sign of God's blessing on the land when he brings it forth. Your grain and your wine and your oil, as we saw all through Deuteronomy, a sign of God's blessing on the land and a people. Philosophers have observed the benefits of wine, too. Dr. Patrick McGovern, he says, fermented beverages have been preferred over water throughout the ages, especially in Mexico and Europe, for that matter, too, right? Fermented beverages have been preferred over water throughout the ages. They are safer, provide psychotropic effects, and are more nutritious. Some have even said alcohol was the primary agent for the development of Western civilization. So there. you teetotalers. I go on to quote Dr. McGovern. Since more healthy individuals, even if inebriated much of the time, lived longer and had greater reproductive success. I think the tongue was a little in cheek there, but he has some points, doesn't he? And of course, Adam Smith, who was an economic philosopher, he saw himself as a life philosopher as well as an economist, one of the first economists. He says, and I quote him, "The cheapness of wine seems to be a cause not of drunkenness, but of sobriety." The inexpensiveness of wine. He says, "People are seldom guilty of excess in what is their daily fare." If indeed the premise is true that wine is a daily fare in much of the lives of many people across the earth. "People are seldom guilty of excess in what is their daily fare. On the contrary, in the countries which, either from excessive heat or cold, produce no grapes, and where wine consequently is dear and a rarity, drunkenness is a common vice." Unquote. And of course, he was an Englishman. It's hard to get grapes to grow in England. They have a lot of hard liquor, the Scots, with them, right? So, my favorite brief description of wine is from Galileo. Galileo said, "Wine is sunlight held in water." Very brief, but very elegant, and very inspired. He must have been maybe under the influence a little when he said it, when he thought of it. Wine is sunlight held in water. So then, wine is the one unqualified savior that endures, right? Nah. He doesn't say that either, does he? He does not answer this immediately, but he does allude to its excess. He is careful to interject this caveat, "My heart still guiding me with wisdom," right? Interjection right in the middle of that verse. He wants to make sure you see that. He is enjoying the pleasure of the vine, but he still has his, in other words, "I'm still sober enough to see truth and reality at the heart of this." Now, many commentators think that Koheleth is being ironic here. That is, his wisdom is really so contrary to that found in the rest of wisdom literature that it really means the opposite of what he says it is. But such a one is thus saying that Solomon's wisdom is really a form of folly, which he will demonstrate throughout Ecclesiastes. I thought about this for a while. I've been working through this for years, thinking about this, but I think it's too clever by half to say such things. It creates far more interpretive problems than it solves. It denies that there can be wise exploration of the good gift of wine. It makes redundant the next phrase, too, "that I might lay hold on folly." If his wisdom is folly, then what is folly? And it also demands that the interpreter henceforth throughout the rest of the book rather subjectively and arbitrarily select when and where Koheleth is ironic, quote unquote. So, as far as I'm concerned, there's no reason not to take him at his word here. By asserting that his heart still guided him with wisdom, he acknowledges the intrinsic dangers of alcohol voiced in the wisdom literature too. Let's sample that a little bit. Turn over with me to Proverbs 23 for just a minute. Once again, he expects you to have at your elbow this companion work. And let's look at Proverbs 23 beginning at verse 29. And see if you don't see some of this in our own day too, wherever the abuse of alcohol occurs. "Who has woe? Who has sorrow? Who has strife? Who has complaining? Who has wounds without cause?" Do you ever see the barflies and the drunkards out on the street, right? Those that have substance problems. "Who has wounds without cause? Who has redness of eyes?" Those who tarry long over wine. Those who go to try mixed wine. "Do not look at wine when it is red, when it sparkles in the cup and goes down smoothly. In the end, it bites like a serpent and stings like an adder. Your eyes will see strange things and your heart utter perverse things. You will be like one who lies down in the midst of the sea, like one who lies on the top of a mast. They struck me, you will say, but I was not hurt. They beat me, but I did not feel it. When shall I awake? I must have another drink. Do you see the humor in this as well? The pathetic humor in such a character. So, implicit in his, I still had my wisdom with me. That is, I still had my wits about me. I saw with clear eye not only the benefits but the dangers of alcohol. Even the world alludes to these woes, doesn't it? One French writer on wine and food said, Burgundy makes you think of silly things, Bordeaux makes you talk of them, and Champagne makes you do them. So, his language here, Solomon's, may sound ironic that one can search out wine and folly, and that by doing so one is sinking into their traps ipso facto. But that simply is too clever by half. The wisdom literature is replete with the understanding of both wisdom and folly, having observed and dealt with them both. That is what Solomon is doing here from the perspective of godly wisdom as well. And it is to this task that Koheleth sets himself. And he does so with a purpose. He says, till I might see what was good for the children of man to do under heaven for the few days of their life. So he brings us back to his major premise. That is, the brevity of this life that we know. Remember, we saw that Hebrew word, kaham, translates better as vapor rather than vanity or meaninglessness. It's this literal translation means vapor. And communicates, indeed, the sense of his text here. Everything is so brief. Nothing endures. Whatever it is may be real, but it evaporates so soon like a mist, right? The brevity of this life that we know, if we restrict it, that is, to this realm exclusively, and that's the sense of under heaven, the very few days of life. Life is the vapor motif. We can call it the vapor motif. So, know this, dear listener, Koheleth is driving us, not to despair and vanity and meaninglessness. The more I see that word in the NIV, the more I think it really is misleading rather than meaninglessness. It is misleading to translate that word as meaninglessness. He is not driving us to some kind of existential despair, but to something higher and more enduring. If we will ransack the rest of Revelation with him, indeed, have at our elbows 1 Kings, Proverbs, Song of Solomon for that matter as well. It is also what we share in common with the rest of our fellow travelers. That is, the rest of us that we march with under the sun, right? You will go out and march with them in your respective workplaces and families and neighborhoods tomorrow. All they know is what is under the sun. And you are now in a position, by the acquisition of this book into your soul, you are in a position to better explain, unfold, articulate what they're experiencing as well. So invite them on this journey with you, not only to those things under the sun, but implicitly, strongly implicitly, those things that are above the sun. So wine and mirth are not the only pleasure givers, are they? Might there not be something more enduring than laughter and wine that perish with the use? Verses 4 to 8. He will also take pleasure in those things he accomplishes, those things he builds. So, pleasure. What would a wise man with unparalleled opportunity, what would he conclude about the enduring quality of pleasure in paradise? Pleasure in paradise. Solomon builds paradise. Great men have always sought to ensconce their memories in a fashion that will endure. Excuse me. Much of the labor for the acquisition of power is to do precisely this. Caesar Augustus, adopted son of Julius Caesar, said, I found Rome brick, I left it marble. The popes, merchants, princes of Italy built their legacies in stone in the great cities of Rome and Venice and Florence. Adolf Hitler, too, for that matter, who flattered himself an artist and an architect, didn't he? He had extensive plans to build architectural monuments to himself, if indeed this Third Reich of his had actually endured 1,000 years. Have you ever seen the plans for this? If you watch the History Channel, I subscribe to the History Channel, which I refer sometimes to the Hitler Channel because they have so much of Hitler and his times on this station. But they will show you some of the plans he had for the plazas and government buildings of the Third Reich. And they were garish, hideous. All of his government buildings looked like brick outhouses, magnified to gigantic proportions. As far as I'm concerned, Hitler's architecture was reason enough to declare war in 1941. But as we observe throughout history, the father grabs power and imposes his peace. The son then maintains that power and builds on it, literally, doesn't he? As certainly as Augustus followed Julius Caesar and Alexander the Great followed Philip of Macedon, so Solomon follows his father David and does literally build upon his legacy. We see in 1 Kings chapter 9, at the end of 20 years, Solomon had built the two houses. These weren't just little ramshackle buildings on a corner lot, were they? These were the two houses, right? The temple and his own kingly house. And all that Solomon had desired to build. So as you read 1 Kings 1 through 11, you see how extravagantly elegant and lavish his building projects were. And here we get an even closer, in Ecclesiastes, an even closer picture of how paradisaical they were. Paradisaical, that is, like paradise, they were. Note for me four things. Note with me four things. Number one. In aspiration with Adam, Solomon built a great city. In aspiration with Adam, Solomon built a great city. There is a garden motif in this, isn't there? Taken together with 1 Kings, here he says, I built houses. What were those? What were those houses, by the way? Once again, not little ramshackle things on the corner, but rather the temple, his own palace. We know that Koheleth utterly remade Jerusalem, such that had David and his generation returned, they wouldn't have recognized it. And in concert with Adam, great men have always built cities, haven't they? It's in our genes. It's in our DNA. Unfortunately, we also know that that DNA is depraved, isn't it? Rife with what we call original sin. Therefore, the cities that we build are inherently flawed and cursed, too. Cursed. There's nothing we can do about that. Though we build a city for eternity, God has cursed creation here and now. And it will not stand, it will not endure, will it? Inherent in that curse is the brevity and fleetingness of cities. He has already alluded to the curse in the past, hasn't he? In first chapter, twice he referred to the curse. My definition of curse, a set of circumstances of sin and misery above which no man can rise in his own ability. A set of circumstances of sin and misery above which no man can rise in his own ability. The brevity and fleetingness of all things is one part of that curse. No matter how adamant the stone, all cities, all buildings will fall. Secondly, note with me as well from this text, in aspiration with Adam, Solomon husbanded flora and fauna. In aspiration with Adam, Solomon husbanded flora and fauna. Once again, we are wired. We are designed to be shepherds and gardeners, aren't we? I see, as I look out on our congregation, I see shepherds, gardeners, shepherds. The language here is coincidental, maybe intentional, with that of Genesis. No, this is deliberately intentional, almost on its face. The planting, the fruit trees, the garden, the pools of water, they all have direct parallels in the opening chapters of Genesis. One commentator does a good job of laying this all out, plotting this all out on a graph. Beautifully done. Solomon had unparalleled opportunity to reprise Adam's ambition. Only graced with a wisdom not seen in a king since, or probably ever will. And in this, he was very successful, was Solomon, arguably more successful than any man before since Adam, pre-fall Adam, that is. Thirdly, note with me as well, in aspiration with Adam, Solomon filled the earth with progeny. Solomon filled the earth with progeny. Here he alludes to this with the many slaves he bought and saw born to him. Read with 1 Kings, once again, we know that he also had many wives and concubines to which many sons and daughters were born. So, Koheleth acts with great gusto to fulfill the creation mandate, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. He was well on his way to doing that, wasn't he? Fourthly, notice with me from this text, in aspiration with Adam, Solomon created a rich culture. Solomon also created a rich culture. A significant phrase points to this, the treasure of kings and provinces. Here, as well, once again in conjunction, right at your elbow, you have 1 Kings 1 through 11. The treasure of kings and provinces. These are objects d'art, if you will. Things like furniture, dishes, fabrics, anything that can be fashioned from elements like silver and gold. These weren't just bare ingots that traveled in on a cart. No, these were the objects of art, the creations of men from all over the world that were brought to Solomon in his palace, filled his palace with these kinds of things, created a rich culture, a musical culture too, is also referenced in the singers he brought to Jerusalem. Wouldn't it be great to have an audio from that period? Many have speculated, for example, on how the melodies flowed in the Psalms. Be great to have a CD of how that actually went down, wouldn't it? Well, once more, these echo the early chapters of Genesis, where the sons of Adam established culture. Jabal, the first skilled shepherd and herdsman, Jubal, the first musician, Tubal-Cain, the first manufacturer of tools. All this is in the record in Genesis chapter 4. So, Solomon had unparalleled opportunity, once again, to cultivate a rich, flourishing, very satisfying culture in Jerusalem, to which men flocked as if it were Paris, New York, and Florence, all rolled into one. 1 Kings 11 recounts that for us. Well, certainly now, right? Now, Pastor, we have reason to believe that Solomon has achieved something important, something satisfying, something enduring. Verses 9 through 11. Let's look at it. Pleasure. What would a wise man, with unparalleled opportunity, conclude about the enduring quality of pleasure in labor? Verses 9 to 11. In these verses, Koheleth figuratively takes a deep breath, sits back, and looks back with this broad sweep of the eyes over all of his labor that he has accomplished. It's one of the many summary statements that come at the conclusion of all his vignettes on wisdom. This is a vignette of his wisdom. Labor and toil will be a recurring theme throughout Ecclesiastes. He's not exhausted this idea of labor and toil either. It will come back all through Ecclesiastes. But it is the pleasure derived from that toil upon which Koheleth pronounces now. Well then, if indeed we are wired, we are created to be builders and husbands and gardeners, doing those things must satisfy and be pleasurable in the end, right? Right? Please say yes. No, not necessarily. Because Solomon concludes several things. Not just one cheap, easy answer. Once again, if that's what you expect from this book, it ain't happening. No cheap, easy, on-the-surface answers. You are expected to interact with this text, make it part of you, work through it in your mind, use biblical wisdom, sharpen biblical wisdom, perhaps cultivate biblical wisdom, so that you can live these things out yourself. So, Solomon concludes several not-so-easy, glib things. Number one, no one did his research more comprehensively than me, he says. No one did his research more comprehensively than me. This is to establish his authority. We ought to take Solomon's judgments with authority precisely because not only was he the most gifted man for the task, but he also exhausted every avenue of research in his topic too. Left no stone unturned, if you will. No highway or byway left unexplored. No delight untasted. I became great and surpassed all before me. Whatever my eyes desired, I got. Kept my heart from no pleasure. This is why we incorporate in every one of our points today a wise man with unparalleled opportunity. I dare say that the world has not seen since Solomon, nor will it see until the regeneration of all things. And that's part of the illusion here, too. One of the sub-questions of this text is this one? Is this the one that was promised in David's promise, David's covenant? Is this the one who will indeed rule from Jerusalem forever? Is he the wisest man that ever lived? Is this indeed the one who has come? So, the world has not seen since Solomon, nor will it see until the regeneration of all things, such a man with such opportunity. No Fermi, no Edison, no Einstein has had such a wide, rich laboratory in which to conduct his experiments, like Solomon. Note with me secondly as well, no one kept his wits about him as evenly as me. No one kept his wits about him as evenly as me. What would you and I do if given the keys to the candy store like Solomon? An unlimited wine cellar? As many books and burgers as you want? An endless Netflix queue, a season pass to Wrigley Field, a palace of concubines and wives that would make Hugh Hefner and his Playboy Mansion look like a pit stop? Somewhere along the line, I dare say, most of us would stumble at one point or another, if not all of them. But Solomon insists that he did not. My wisdom remained with me, at least for the sake of the argument of his book. Now, of course, he will stumble later in his life, but at least for the sake of the argument of this book, my wisdom remained with me. And he proves it, too, by his consistent biblical conclusions. Thirdly, no one gained more pleasure from my labor than me. No one gained more pleasure from my labor than me. Is there pleasure and reward for hard work and achievement? Many of you know it in your own lives, don't you? Yes, of course there is. Yes, of course there is. Pleasure and enjoyment and reward for toil. This is not ironic. It is not disingenuous. It is not illusory. Solomon is being real and genuine here. He actually took great satisfaction in his project paradise. And well, he should. This impulse is confirmed in all men, isn't it? Wise men everywhere love to work and enjoy it. We're wired and created to labor and create after the image of the God who made us. And if you're in a field, a job, a career, a calling that you love, you look forward every day going to work, you are blessed. Dear friend, you are blessed, are you not? One of the great secrets of life is to learn to work. To learn to work. Fathers, are you listening? Teach your sons how to work. Find work consonant with your gifts then, and then go at it. Go at it. And when you do, surprise, you begin to profit from it and enjoy it too. My sons-in-law are two examples. Debbie was just alluding to Gideon. Gideon has people flock to him for counsel and advice. He has a listening ear. He's a natural in these things. It's only reasonable that he's training as a counselor and loving it. Chris, my other son-in-law, Chris Jones. He's a born, well-wired scholar. It's only reasonable that he's training as an academic and loves it. We were born to labor. And the sin in Solomon, if the text was trying to communicate that to us, would be in refusing to labor and taking no pleasure in it. A producer at Fox News interviewed many of the radical Marxist protesters at the Occupy Wall Street demonstration. Perhaps you've seen that coming and going on television lately. He asked several of them, "Don't you have a job?" Some of the answers. Where do you hear some of the answers? "I'm on unemployment. I ain't working for $11 an hour." Another said, "I'm waiting for my career to kick in." He expected to step right into an ad position on, what's the street where all the ad agencies are? Anyway. And another says, "I had a job, but I quit to come here." That was my favorite. I practically choked on my dinner. This is not the frame of mind that Koheleth will inculcate. We are to take at face value the affirmation, "My heart found pleasure in all my toil, and this was my reward for all my toil." Take that at face value. He means it. Number four as well. Solomon asserts, "No one knows the vaporous brevity of labor better than me." No one knows the vaporous brevity of labor better than me. Once more, Solomon does not wail like an overwrought fishwife, "All is vain and meaningless and worthless and empty. I should just end it all now." Is that what he's saying? He does not flatly contradict what he has just said, pleasure in labor, reward for toil. So if you continue to read vanity or meaninglessness, you're going to have cognitive dissonance. If you continue to take the dark, skeptical view of Ecclesiastes, this is what you are forced to do all through this book. And that is not what Solomon is trying to communicate. He's not a schizophrenic, irrational basket case, but rather a wise, rational potentate with a rare opportunity and vast laboratory to conduct this project paradise with wisdom at his side. What he does note, in addition to the satisfaction that labor brings, is that it does not last. As we've been maintaining throughout the book, and will be consistent in the most reasonable interpretation throughout, I submit to you, vapor is a better translation than vanity, meaninglessness, because it literally describes the brief vanishing nature of all things under the sun. As we saw last week, this is also the synonymous sense of a striving after wind, too. So brief and fleeting. Striving after wind. The things pursued under the sun are not utterly worthless and bankrupt and meaningless, but are rather brief, fleeting. They do not endure, including our labor. All of Brian's common sense stores will one day turn to dust. I'm sure he doesn't want to hear that now as he's putting all this work and labor in at the front end. John's fountains one day will shut off and decay. All of the devices which perform better under the duress of heat, courtesy of Dean Breyer's skills, they will one day seize up and freeze and be discarded, won't they, Dean? Well, let's all cry. Have a good cry. Does this mean that Brian, John, and Dean should quit and go mope in a corner, covering themselves in dust and ashes? No, it's not what he's saying at all. Work, get paid well, and enjoy the fruits of your labor while you can under the sun. It is to this you were made, you're wired, and your Lord expects you to do. However, another message must come searing through. It's all vapor. Disappears. Like fog in a brilliant sun, like mist thrown by an ocean wave, the steam from your cup of tea in the morning. It should also herald another voice, which Koheleth is stirring in you. And that he is intending to do. He wants to do this too, stir this other voice in you. If nothing endures beneath the sun, what are things above the sun? To dead men, lost in the world, that's only something of what you hear, something you don't know, but something we call men and women too. Solomon is living within the confines of this book, within the confines of life under the sun, for the sake of drawing others to that place above the sun. It is his art and his science to goad and provoke you to yearn after and seek for that life above the sun where things do endure. Not by baldly laying it out there for you so you can have convenient proof texts to point to. This is not a proof text book, as is most of the Bible, for those of you that still rely on proof text for all your demonstrations. But he does this rather by relentlessly pointing out the vaporousness of this life while seeking out, laying hold of the wisdom that comes only from God. Your fellow travelers know these things. You can demonstrate them from the text. There is a resonant text with every lost man here in this book. Koheleth assumes the persona of your fellow traveler. His words can resonate with them, all the while pointing them to life above the sun. This comes with the wisdom that only comes from God. Ultimately, right? Comes only from God and Christ, ultimately. Christ, who is the power of God and the wisdom of God, as Paul says. Solomon was a builder of cities, as are so many lost men. It is Christ who is building a city above the sun that one day will descend with enduring permanence. Here we have no lasting city, the author of Hebrews says. Here we have no lasting city. He understands the vaporousness, the brevity of life. Here we have no lasting city, but we seek the city that is to come. It is to that city that we point, brothers and sisters in Christ, to that city that we point, and we are intended to point others to as well. So let us now come to a taste then of that day when that enduring city will come.